Hello everyone. I just want to share this lecture that I came across from Oregon State University. Dr. Kevin Ahern. The title of the lecture is Viral Intelligence. What is coronavirus?
A few months ago, if someone had told you that schools, workplaces, transportation networks, and even cities, regions, and countries all over the world would go into lockdown, that might have seemed quite incredible. What could possibly lead to such disruption of life across the entire world? Today, of course, everyone knows the answer to that question. It's the disease COVID-19, short for Coronavirus Disease 2019. Similar to how the disease called AIDS is caused by the virus called HIV, the COVID-19 disease is caused by a virus with the name Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome Coronavirus 2, or simply SARS-CoV-2. This virus is a member of a family, all called coronaviruses, all of which attack the airways and lungs of animals. There are hundreds of such viruses, only a few of which infect humans. While most coronaviruses are confined to other animals, some occasionally mutate and make the leap from birds, bats, or other organisms to humans. And that is how a new disease suddenly emerges, apparently out of the blue, when a virus that only infected other animals is now able to infect ourselves. The virus that first emerged in Wuhan, China in December 2019 is a brand new coronavirus, so it's also referred to as a novel coronavirus, one that didn't exist before. Although it causes respiratory illness similar to a flu virus, the coronavirus causing COVID-19 is not a flu virus. The two viruses are not in any way related genetically to each other, and their modes of action are quite distinct. And because we've never encountered this coronavirus before, our immune systems haven't had the chance to learn how to deal with it. To understand what a coronavirus is and how to fight it, we must start by realizing that viruses are not technically living things. All living things, from bacteria to humans, are made up of units called cells, where the important feature is an ability to make more cells. To do this, cells have to make copies of the cellular information stored in their DNA, build enough of other cellular components, and then divvy up the DNA and cellular components between the original cell and new cell. This is how new cells are made. Viruses, however, have no cells at all. This is why antibiotics, which are designed to block cell processes in bacteria, cannot be effective against viruses. Instead, viruses are very tiny particles, much smaller than a bacterial cell. What viruses do have is information for making copies of themselves. Some viruses store that information in a double helix of DNA. Others, including coronaviruses, do not bother with DNA at all and store their information in a single strand of the related molecule, RNA. For coronaviruses, this single strand of RNA functions both in place of DNA to store genetic information and as the messenger RNA that tells how to make proteins from this same information. The coronavirus's RNA is wrapped up in a little structure of ball-like proteins called capsid proteins, or nucleocapsids. This compact little structure is then surrounded with a matrix of three more structural proteins and coated in a greasy membrane layer of fatty molecules called lipids. However, viruses in general have none of the actual materials and few of the tools they need to build a new virus particle. To reproduce, a virus must sneak into a cell, set up shop, and steal its resources. The virus starts with spike proteins embedded in the surface of the fatty layer. It is the spike proteins which give the coronavirus its name, its distinctive shape, and its method of breaking into cells. A coronavirus uses its spike protein as a sort of key, which it inserts into a compatible receptor protein on the surface of the cell it infects. The specific receptor targeted is called ACE2, which is abundant in cells of the respiratory tract, and why you need to be careful to avoid touching your hands to your face. By attaching to a cell receptor, the virus gains entry into that cell in a process called endocytosis, where the virus is absorbed into the inner portion of the cell. Once inside, the coronavirus releases RNA instructions for making new copies of itself, and it hijacks cellular resources to make thousands of new virus particles. Structural integrity for the virus particles come from the virus's membrane, M, and envelope, E, proteins, which also play important roles in the process by which the viral particles assemble, mature, and are released from the cell, a process called morphogenesis. Assembly of the virus takes place during these proteins' movement through the cell, where they get refined by cellular machinery, including the endoplasmic reticulum and Golgi apparatus, en route to their exit from the cell. During the assembly of a viral particle, the virus also steals lipids from the infected cell to wrap itself in a lipid membrane. Now, not all viruses are enveloped in a lipid membrane, but the fact that the coronavirus is an enveloped virus gives more protection for the capsid, a stickier structure for attaching to new cells, and perhaps greater concealment from antibodies. The finished viral particle travels to new cells via drops of watery fluids. The watery fluids are why social distancing recommendations focus on eliminating exposure to virus-containing droplets, typically expelled from the mouth and nose by sneezing or coughing, and making their way to ACE2 receptors in your airways and lungs. The fatty envelope of the virus helps explain why washing hands with soap and water is a simple means of fighting viral spread. This works because the soap does two things. First, the greasy lipid coating of the virus is dissolved by soap. Without that protective layer, the virus falls apart. Second, soap also disrupts the structure of the spike proteins and the nucleocapsid proteins coating the RNA in the core of the virus. Disrupted proteins no longer function, so the spike protein can't bind to cellular receptors, and the RNA is no longer protected. In short, soap delivers a triple punch. It dissolves the lipid coating, it disrupts binding by the spike proteins, and it disrupts any proteins protecting the RNA. Bare RNAs are extraordinarily unstable outside of a viral particle and are readily destroyed. Alcohol-based hand sanitizers with ethanol or isopropanol work similarly, in part by altering the chemistry of the watery drops surrounding the virus. As small alcohol molecules surround the virus, reducing the amount of water, this has two effects. First, alcohol loosens and at high enough concentration damages the tight lipid layer. This allows the alcohol to gain access to any of the viral proteins. If the lipid layer is sufficiently damaged, this also unmasks the nucleocapsids hiding inside the lipid. Second, alcohol disrupts the hydrogen bonds that help stabilize all of the virus proteins, causing them to lose the bonds holding the virus particle together. So similar to what happens with soap, the viral particle is destabilized, the RNA is released, and again, quickly becomes unstable outside the viral particle. The body fights the virus by activating immune system cells called macrophages. These cells help protect the body by engulfing and digesting foreign substances that lack the type of proteins specific to a healthy body. Together with T cells and other immune system cells, macrophages release signaling molecules called cytokines that can induce inflammation to attack and protect against the virus. The immune system, however, can overreact, as sometimes happens with flu, during more severe infections, when the lungs can get inflamed due to secondary infections of viral or bacterial pneumonia. So as the body tries to fight off the pneumonia, the immune system may go into overdrive and release floods of cytokines. Paradoxically, this cytokine storm, as it's called, which is aimed at defending the body against infection, can instead cause acute respiratory distress and damage the lung cells the body is trying to save. Finding a coronavirus vaccine to prevent the disease before it can start is challenging because the body needs an accurate preview of the virus in order to mobilize the immune system. For instance, the RNA for this coronavirus partially nests in on itself. This makes for partially overlapping regions called pseudonods, which are harder to study and harder to mimic. No RNA vaccines have been approved for any human disease in the past, but if found, an RNA vaccine may be faster to design and manufacture, since the key information is already contained in the RNA genome of the coronavirus. The more typical approach for a vaccine, as with vaccines for polio, flu, or measles, is to expose the body to a viral protein. Of course, any vaccine needs to avoid causing full-blown disease, so the vaccine uses only a portion of an active virus or a partially inactivated version of the full virus. Whether attacking RNA or a protein, what the immune system is finely tuned to do is recognize a foreign structure and make antibodies that bind to that specific structure and block its function. Once we understand which structures to target, we can introduce disabled versions of these structures to the immune system in the form of a vaccine. When the immune system sees these new structures, it constructs antibodies to bind to them, and their binding leads to inhibition of viral action. Now, until vaccines are available, one time-honored technique reported effective against severe cases of Spanish flu back in 1918 was to treat patients with blood plasma from those who had recovered from the virus. The idea here is that purified plasma from people who have recovered could offer antibodies capable of fighting COVID-19 in the recipient. Now, there's drug research aiming to exploit at least three targets in the coronavirus life cycle. The first involves blocking attachment and entry of the virus to the cell. This would mean finding molecules that can bind to the spike protein and prevent it from binding to the ACE2 receptor. Here, either a drug or a vaccine might take this approach. The second approach involves inhibiting copying of the viral RNA. Now that the virus's RNA genome has been completely sequenced and 15 genes identified, scientists are racing to understand more fully the structural features of this viral genome's 30,000 bases. Normally, the virus replicates when it converts the RNA strand from the genome into a complementary copy of itself, thanks to a helper called RNA polymerase. Researchers designate the genome strand plus because it can be directly translated into protein. The complementary strand to the plus strand, made by the RNA polymerase, is a strand called minus. It is the minus strand that is subsequently copied repeatedly by the same RNA polymerase to make the plus strands that are needed to make viral particles. So, inhibiting the RNA polymerase will stop RNA copying of both plus and minus strands and halt the virus in its tracks. One such drug may be remdesivir, which was originally intended to block the RNA polymerase of Ebola, though significant clinical trials will be necessary to determine its safety and effectiveness for treating coronavirus patients. The third approach might involve blocking action of viral proteins inside of cells. This can help reduce the likelihood of the virus being able to properly function once it is inside of a cell. Intense efforts are underway to determine the structures of the viral proteins so drugs can be designed that attach precisely to these proteins and disable their functions. One promising strategy is to target a cellular enzyme called a protease that is needed to convert a large viral protein complex called a polyprotein into the smaller protein pieces needed by the virus. By inhibiting the cellular protease involved in this process, it might be possible to block the virus from effectively reproducing itself. Blocking the action of a cellular protease is one aspect of HIV treatment, for example, that has been successful. What sort of targeting are we trying to hit? Compared to other RNA viruses, a coronavirus genome approaches the upper limit in size for the known RNA viruses. It's about twice the size of a flu virus genome. Scientists may be able to exploit the genome's larger size when trying to disrupt the tightly packed coronavirus particle. Also, unlike the flu virus, replication of the larger RNA genome of the novel coronavirus seems to include some molecular proofreading that reduces the rate of mutation well below that of flu virus mutations, meaning that scientists working on coronavirus have less of a moving target to try to hit. We've already been living with a worldwide spread of four milder members of the coronavirus family, two known since the 1960s and two discovered in 2003. These four coronaviruses are partly responsible for about a quarter of common cold cases, although colds are also caused by smaller RNA-based rhinoviruses, as well as by larger DNA-based adenoviruses. Each strain of severe human coronavirus has mutated in animals and then jumped separately to humans. But despite evolving separately, the severe coronaviruses that have infected humans seem to have very little difference in their main structural proteins. It may be that greater mutations in so-called accessory proteins differentiates how fast spreading the novel coronavirus is, compared with its slower spreading but more deadly original SARS coronavirus that appeared in China in 2002, or the MERS virus, Middle Eastern Respiratory Virus, which appeared in the Middle East in 2012. These two viruses respectively killed 10% and 30% of those they infected, but fortunately traveled much slower than the virus causing COVID-19. Thousands of existing drugs, as well as potential new treatments, are being screened for their ability to block virus attachment, interfere with copying, or disrupt virus proteins. Small-scale studies are the quickest and easiest to do, but may report apparently good results that occur merely by chance. That's why large-scale studies will also be needed to verify any promising results. Until effective treatments are available, we should each do whatever we can to reduce and delay the spread of the virus. But what's wonderful is how scientists all over the world are working furiously to develop vaccines and treatments. It's inspiring to follow their efforts, from the remarkably fast start of early stage testing to what we can all hope will soon be significant advances towards a cure for COVID-19.